Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Drew Gonzer, and I'm here on behalf of the appellate Deshaun Drumgo. Our opening brief raised three issues. I'm going to focus on the third of those issues at first here today. That issue is whether or not Mr. Drumgo was denied a fair trial as a result of prosecutorial misconduct during closing argument. In the fall of October, Mr. Drumgo went to trial. It was a three-day trial. Closing arguments were on the fourth day for murder in the first degree, among other charges. On the third day of trial, Mr. Drumgo elected to put his credibility at issue and testified on his own behalf. He is the only witness who testified in his defense. The state put on 11 witnesses in their case in chief. Mr. Drumgo was the only one to testify in his behalf. In closing, as my opening brief outlines, there were four statements made by the prosecutor, the first of which, and I'll just quote it here, it says, "It all winds up in the evidence, except his ridiculous story that he came in here and told you about a phantom man." A couple of things about that. One, it all winds up in the evidence. The only evidence other than Mr. Drumgo's ridiculous story, so to speak, is state's evidence, state's exhibits, and state witnesses. The other piece about that particular statement.
Make a connection there for me?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Make a connection there for me. That said, what's the significance of it?
Because, Your Honor, what she's saying is, the prosecutor is saying, is all the evidence winds up. It all comes together except his story. In other words, all the evidence, my witnesses, they all come together. The only thing that doesn't is his ridiculous story that he came in and told you.
That's what winds up means?
Yes, Your Honor.
Winds up doesn't mean closed, finished, no more.
No. What it means is, she's saying all the evidence comes together.
Well, what's the matter with that if the court traditionally gives an instruction to make one harmonious story of it all, but if you can't, you can reject people's testimony?
Well, the problem is that decision wasn't left to the jury. The prosecutor interjected her own personal opinion about it by saying his story is ridiculous, everything else makes sense.
Is there any adjective that a prosecutor can use to describe someone's story?
Well, I suppose there are adjectives that could be used if they don't relate to the prosecutor or an attorney's personal opinion.
Well, could they say unbelievable story?
Well, that's kind of where the problem arises, because we have another case that was cited by the state, and the quote was, his story is a crock, or it's from left field, you know, and here we have it's ridiculous. We've had other cases where they talk about, well, flat out being a lie, but that's different from what you're asking. And the problem is that in any of those cases, it's the prosecutor or the state's opinion about the testimony, and you know, if I suppose you could get into a scenario where now we have to decide what type of adjective is okay, what is benign, that's the state's word in their answering brief, or what adjective has just crossed the line. And I'm not sure that when...
Well, should they use stilted phrases like, the defendant's story, I submit to you, is unworthy of belief? Does that dress it up? I mean, what is that saying? Is that saying that it's based on a lie? Is it saying that it's unbelievable? Is it saying that it's incredible? Is it saying that it's ridiculous? And what, when all is said and done, other than ridiculous sounds denigrating, when it's all said and done, is there no comment allowed at all on the fact that the other side's story doesn't make sense given all of the evidence wound together?
Well, I think if it's put in context of, you know, the state's witnesses testified to this. They saw this. They saw that. He's the only one who didn't see that. He's the only one who testified otherwise. The state says this. Drumgo. He's the only one versus 11 witnesses who testified in opposition to the 11 witnesses, and then say something, I guess, along the lines of, and that's for the jury to decide whether or not to believe, you know, the witnesses.
Okay.
And the reference to all winds up in the evidence included your client's testimony, though, right?
Well, that was the exclusion that she said. It all winds up in the evidence except his story. The next statement that was made, let me just back up. The reference to the Phantom Man. There was testimony that potentially there was a third person hiding in the shadows that may have been involved in this matter. That was part of Drumgo's defense when he testified. The detective, I believe it was Detective Flaherty, when he was asked questions by defense counsel, he agreed that there was a third person in the shadows. The dispute was whether or not that person made contact with the victim. And there's repeated, I believe, three or four references to this Phantom Man, that the only one who saw was Drumgo, which was inaccurate on the record. The next statement relates to a characterization of Mr. Drumgo's testimony as a sales pitch. And the state said in closing, he told you he would talk to Candace Brown all day long if he could have gotten her to buy something. That's what he tried to do to you, ladies and gentlemen. Don't buy it. And again, the first thing is it's not entirely what he said. What he said to about Candace Brown was, if you want to buy something, I'll stand there and talk to you all day long. He didn't say, if I could have gotten her to buy something, I would stand there and talk to her all day long. And by using the phrase sales pitch and urging the jury not to buy it, what we've done with all the negative connotations that there are to a sales pitch and salesman is, again, interjected the prosecutor's, I suppose, personal opinion, as well as trying to arouse the jury's prejudices against that type of pitch, if you will. The next statement was, and didn't Drumgo tell you he saw a shiny object? Ladies and gentlemen, what an insult to your intelligence. This again, and the idea behind that from the state's statement in closing was that, what an insult to your intelligence, this all happened under a big shady tree. There couldn't have been a shiny object. You know, what he really said was, I saw a silver object, which is just what the state's witness said, Andre Young. He saw a silver object. He clarified later that, and the state asked, well, how do you know it was a silver object? And he said, well, the sun glinted off it, you know, like if your watch catches the sun. That's what that reference there is to. But again, we're talking about a big courtyard, one shady tree, and a scuffle that's going on. And not direct testimony from Drumgo that he saw a shiny object. It was just further clarification that he was trying to describe what he had seen.
Now, there was no objection at trial to any of these comments, correct?
That's correct.
So how do you satisfy the Wainwright test for plain error?
Well, Your Honor, first, Mr. Drumgo has a substantial right to a fair trial. Our position that we laid out in our brief is that these comments prejudice that right. They are material defects. They're in the record. You can read them right from the cold record. We believe that they're serious and fundamental, and they affected his right, number one, to a fair trial, and number two, to present his own defense. I mean, he essentially, what happens is he gets up and makes his argument or makes his defense, and then the state gets up in closing and says what he said was ridiculous, you know? And it's just, it prejudiced his right to do that.
All right. Well, that, to a large extent, sounds conclusory to me. Can you be any more specific as to why it was plain error?
I'm not sure I understand.
How how he was denied a fair trial?
Well, what happens is this is a very close case. We have his story. We have very conflicting eyewitness testimony. We have an extremely poor quality video. We have no motive. We have no weapon. And we have a jury who does not convict on the lead charge of murder one. They convict on murder two, a lesser included offense. And we have, in the summations, the jury, you know, wrestling with all these things, and then a prosecutor saying that essentially, and I think it's actually in the closing, she, after these comments, she says, after all this, what you're left with is either murder one or murder two. And that's what they come back with, is murder two. And we really have no way of knowing whether or not the jury was influenced by the prosecutor's comments or whether they weren't. And that's why, you know, that's how the prejudice falls on Mr. Drumgo, because he's, you know, now got this murder two conviction. He's sitting there, and we really don't know what happened. It was a very close case. If that answers your question.
You may continue.
Yeah, thank you. And then finally, the last argument, or the last statement that we pointed out was that the prosecutor says, you know, Drumgo walked out of that courtyard, and then she interrupts herself and says, by the way, wasn't that cute at the end of cross-examination yesterday when all of a sudden he was too confused to say which way he went? And again, it's personal opinion from the prosecutor as to the testimony of Drumgo. It's not persuasive. I mean, perhaps she's trying to be persuasive with these comments. But even a cold reading from the – I mean, you can almost read the sarcasm in the, by the way, wasn't that cute? And that's just from a cold reading of the record. And these comments, they just – they're not appropriate. This court has gone, I think, all the way back – in Bennett, I think it was, in 1960, when the court was addressing prosecutorial misconduct, it starts with the phrase, here we are again addressing these issues. And that's all the way back in 1960. And maybe it's a training issue. Maybe, I don't know what it is, but they're continuing. And in 2002, in Williams v. State, the court said, in the future, this conduct will not be tolerated. And I guess the issue really is, where do we draw the line in terms of how much the prosecutor is allowed to inject those types of comments.
But, Counselor, hasn't the court also been pretty emphatic about putting some burden on defense counsel to stand up and object to this kind of thing, because the trial judge is in a position at the time it's happening to either tell the prosecutor to change his or her tactics, or to overrule the objection. But to come up on appeal on something that you never raised, isn't that as much a part of all of our case law that's concerned about prosecutorial misconduct as the conduct of the prosecutors that we're worried about?
Yes, that's absolutely true. And I think one of the cases, it may have been Baker, said that, just as you said, Your Honor, the courts have come down equally hard on defense counsel. Their obligation here, the trial attorney's obligation, was to raise a timely objection. That didn't happen. There wasn't an objection. There was nothing. And I don't have an answer as to why that is.
Well, that doesn't mean we ignore what occurred by any means, and I'm sure no one's question from the bench is suggesting that at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the burden is on you on appeal now to convince us that not only that this was prosecutorial misconduct that constituted error, but that it was plain error, and it should undermine our confidence in the verdict as a result. How does this undermine our confidence in the verdict?
Well, Your Honor, like I said earlier, this is not a slam dunk type of case. In the cases where, as cited by the state, I think it was Warren v. State, where there's an issue like this raised on plain error, and yet the decision is affirmed. The difference is that those were not close cases, and they say that right in the opinion. This was a close case. That's the difference here, and we don't you have a close case, conflicting testimony from all of the witnesses, conflicting over whether or not Drumgo was in the courtyard, conflicting on whether or not the witnesses were even there, what he was wearing, whether he was punched or all of these conflicts are in the testimony. And then you have Drumgo. He testifies on what his position is, what he says happened. And then you have these comments, and there's no way to know. You can't look, like, put the comments aside and look at the record and say, well, we probably came out to the right decision anyway. And those are my terms. But you can't do that here, because if you put those comments aside, you're still left with no weapon, no motive, a conviction on a lesser-included offense, conflicting testimony. It's just not a close case.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
If it pleases the Court, since my colleague confined his comments to the third argument, I will do also, unless the Court has some questions on the other arguments that were raised. I referred to the comments in my answering brief as editorial comments. They are not inflammatory words such as cute, even ridiculous. Are they necessary? Of course not. The prosecutor could have made her point simply by eliminating the editorial comments. And in this regard, I will say that each of these comments simply are all tied to some specific evidence that she's talking about, and saying, you know, this simply doesn't jive with the other evidence in the case, the ridiculous story. Mr. Drumgo's testimony is simply out of sync with the testimony of the other witnesses. Then the editorial commentary is certainly not necessary. However, it's not inflammatory by any means. Mr. Gonzer, in his reply brief, cites to Hardy in support of his argument here. And, of course, in Hardy there were comments such as the state sort of vets these cases before we get them. Things like that, that were certainly go beyond the pale of simply editorial commentary and hit you in the face as reversible error, whether there's an objection to them or not. And, of course, in this case, there was no objection. Mr. T's, whether these even registered in any way, shape, or form was improper, I don't know. I didn't talk to Mr. T's, but it's clear that he did not think they were worth an objection, even if they did register whatsoever. But the sales pitch and don't buy it, once again, tied to Mr. Drumgo's own testimony that he's a wonderful salesman and he'll talk to you forever. I don't know that there really is anything quite improper about that. She used it to wind it up. Don't buy it. That is, don't buy the things that this salesman, this fast-talking salesman, Mr. Drumgo, is trying to sell you. Cute? I don't know what to say about cute. Don't know what it means, actually. But wasn't it cute at the end? Well, that, again, is tied in with the fact that he realized all of a sudden that his story, he wasn't quite sure which way the camera was going to show he left, and so he got confused about that. So each of these comments ties into some specific evidence that the prosecutor was talking about. Oh, and the final one, the insult to your intelligence, once again, to the fact that from the camera angle, from the security camera, it was clear that everything took place beneath a in the shadow, in the shade of a tree, and so nothing would shine or glint in the sunlight, as she was saying, and mentioned that the two maintenance men, or rather one maintenance man, said he saw a metal object but said nothing about a shiny object. Again, another example where Drumgo's story conflicts with the other evidence.
Wasn't the prosecutor showing disdain for the defendant by some of these terms?
I think the prosecutor was showing disdain for the defendant's story, and I think these are ad hominem attacks. I don't think she's attacking him personally, but she is attacking his testimony, definitely. Definitely saying that this testimony simply is not worthy of your belief, which is what it all comes down to, and saying why. It conflicts. It is simply in opposite to everything else you've heard and seen from the security cameras, from whatever you can make out on it.
Isn't that the problem, though, with using hyperbole in the way in which you point out to the jury that the stories are conflicting and that the state's proffered evidence is more convincing than the defense's proffered evidence? When you use terms that suggest that you're denigrating an individual who's being prosecuted for serious crime.
Maybe everybody in this room has got it at some point, usually from an English teacher. They'll give back an essay and say, "Don't say it. Show it. Don't say it. Show it." And I think that's the basic problem we find here. I mean, here the prosecutor was showing it, but then at some point then she has put in this saying, you know, sort of, oh, and the conclusion is you just think this story is ridiculous. Oh, the conclusion is what you should do is think of this as cute. Something like that. It's not necessary. Quite frankly, it's not good rhetoric. It's not very persuasive. I mean, you can show it without saying it.
Convince me that it's not personally denigrating. And what is the danger of a prosecutor with all the power that the prosecutor holds, particularly when it's combined with really persuasive talent, to use terminology that appears to denigrate the accused as a person, rather than just take issue with the facts and the story that the defendant tells?
No, I agree. It's not proper. It is not proper and should be avoided. And your Honor is right. I mean, one can very easily go beyond the relatively innocuous kinds of statements you see here and go over the edge and talk about the defendant's, well, the case this court has seen over the years, where I come close to or actually going into personal attacks. I mean, it's a fine line. It's just best to stay away from it altogether. The editorial comments, I don't think are now, I'm sure people would disagree with me, but I don't think they're necessary at all. I think you can show a story as simply out in left field without actually saying that it is. And I personally think that's more effective argumentation than calling either the individual or the story.
Well, tell us why we, despite these hyperbolic characterizations of the defendant's testimony, why should we be confident that this verdict is correct and was fairly rendered?
Well, the verdict, first of all, I don't think these four editorial comments had anything to do with the jury's verdict. The jury did come back with a lesser-included offense, of second-degree murder rather than first-degree murder, obviously looking over the evidence and not finding a formed intent to kill, but nevertheless deciding that stabbing someone in the chest certainly was more than mere recklessness. That is, they also rejected manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide and came up with a fair and just verdict under the circumstances that when you stab someone in the chest, you may not have a formed intent to kill, but you certainly are displaying a cruel, wicked, and depraved indifference to human life. You don't care if the person lives or dies.
How close was this case?
I'm sorry?
How close was this case?
Oh, I don't think it was close at all. I mean, you had Arion Weiss and the one witness who actually did see the stabbing itself. You had other witnesses you have the two maintenance men who saw what they characterized as a punch, but then one saw Mr. Drumgo put an object in his back pocket, and the other said it was a metal object in his back pocket. And you had another witness. Let me see the name. She testified just before Miss Weiss, and her name was, I will have it in a moment, Ina Gardner, who saw the punch like many other people did, but then heard L, as she called him, Mr. Larkin, say, he poked me, and she explained that poking in this context meant stabbed. So there's quite a bit of evidence, plus, of course, whatever the security camera video showed. Didn't show the stabbing, but did show the confrontation between the two. But Ms. Weiss said that she saw Mr. Drumgo go up to Mr. Larkin, punch him in the face, and then, as Mr. Larkin stood there stunned, take out a knife and stab him in the chest. And of course, this is all consistent with the medical testimony that he did, in fact, die from a knife wound that severed a major blood vessel, and he bled, his lung had a major blood vessel, and he bled to death. So the case certainly seems to be quite strong. And again, as the prosecutor pointed out, Mr. Drumgo's testimony simply doesn't square with anything else they heard. Oh, yeah, there may have been certain conflicts about whether he was, whether Mr. Drumgo punched and kicked him after he was down. Ms. Weiss said he did. But ample testimony that he did something with his fist, and other testimony that backing up Ms. Weiss's testimony that certainly he stabbed him. So I think it's a very strong case, very strong case. The court has any questions about any of the other two arguments, or more questions about this, I'd be happy to entertain them. I don't think it would be fair to me to address the other two arguments with since my colleague did not do so.
Would you agree that the record is clear about the conversation that the trial judge had with the jurors who had interaction with a state witness?
Yes, that's in the record, yes. Yes, I should point out, and for some reason in my brief, I talk about juror number 4 and juror number 9. It's actually juror number 1 and juror number 9. For some reason, my 1 got turned into a 4.
But there's really no issue that the trial judge put on the record what happened and then made a ruling consistent with that.
Yeah, so the trial judge talked to both jurors, okay, and they explained what happened, and between the two of them, it's fairly clear what went on. And indeed, Mr. Gonzer identified who this witness was. It was the one that drove Mr. Larkin to the hospital. So that was her. And the reason the juror number 1 knew her again was she worked at Al Sporting Goods for a while and then worked at Walmart, and this was a customer.
All right. Thank you.
I should also point out that she immediately told the bailiff about it. So thank you.
Unless there are any questions from the court, I'll conclude my argument.
Well, I just have one, and you may have already answered it. There may not be a better answer, but you can appreciate, I assume, that it's a bit perplexing to at least one of us that one side tells us the facts are perfectly clear,
mm-hmm,
it's a very strong case in favor of the prosecution, that even with these statements as objectionable as they may have been, had there been an objection at the time, and an opportunity given to cure them, at least after the first one, to prevent the next three from ever happening, arguably. When all is said and done, it's a strong case, then you tell us that the state's evidence is so conflicting,
mm-hmm,
that it's a close case, and this denigration of the defendant's version of the facts is sufficient to undermine our confidence in the outcome.
how do I put that together?
Well, Your Honor, let me see if this helps. Because the statements were so conflicting, I made a chart. Arianna Weiss, who the state said actually saw the stabbing, if you will, she actually testified that she saw multiple stabbings in Drumgo's side. There was only one stab wound in the chest. She also says she was right there. The first punch knocked him right to the ground. Very clear.
But she identified your client as the one causing all of this.
Yes. Ms. Gardner, who also says she was out on the front steps watching this, says Ms. Weiss says first punch did not knock him down. Ells kind of stood up to it as if there's a bunch of language in there about manning up, so to speak. You know, he had taken off his shirt and he was sort of manning up. First punch didn't have any effect on him. Ms. Gardner says she's out on the front steps. First punch knocked him right to the ground. Then Shamika Weiss, Ariana's sister, says, oh, wait, Ms. Gardner, she wasn't even outside. She was upstairs with my mom when all this was going on. I kind of was watching through my window. Candace Brown, who testified, said she didn't even see Drumgo in the courtyard at all. Ebony Coleman, who testified, said she saw Larry Larkin, Ells, that's what he's called in the transcript, and Drumgo just wrestling in the dirt, and she thought they were playing around, didn't think anything of it. So those are some of the conflicting stories that you're getting from, and these are the state's witnesses. And this is not a case where you have, like there was one that I read where it was sort of like an intersection, and you have witnesses from each of the different corners, so you're kind of piecing it together from their different perspectives. These are people who are saying, I was right there watching, and they're all different.
But there's no question that the defendant was present. There's no question that the deceased died from a stab wound.
That's correct.
And there's no question, at least partially confirmed by a video surveillance camera, even if some witnesses have different recollections of particulars of the incident.
That's correct. He himself testified that he was in the courtyard.
Okay. Anything further?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.